This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Anthony Shadid, is in Baghdad, reporting for The Washington Post. He's reported for most of the countries in the Middle East and is the author of the book Legacy of the Prophet, Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. We called him at his hotel in Baghdad this morning as the city was preparing for urban battle to begin. How are you preparing for fighting in Baghdad?
You know, it's interesting. I was talking with my a colleague of mine here, and you know, we talked about how these 2 weeks we were ready for. We knew what was going to happen. We had a sense of how things might unfold. I don't think anybody expected the war to go on as long as it has, but we kind of knew what the initial period would be, and we knew what our role would be here as well. That the government had an interest in getting its word out, and you know, we would listen to that word, and we would try to do our own work as well. But you know, in our conversation last night, we had no idea about what's next. I mean, like a lot of people in Baghdad today, we were mystified about what's about to take place. You know, we made precautions. We have, you know, black jackets, helmets, chemical suits. We've tried to make contingency plans to go to Iran, perhaps, or to go to Jordan. If things really do get out of hand here. But, you know, I think these are all plans and they're all kind of talk at this point. And, you know, I guess the real sense is just to, you know, play it day by day and hope that things go as well as they have so far. And if they don't, be flexible enough that you can change plans, you can, you know, look for alternatives and just try to kind of stay light on your feet.
Are you afraid?
I am. You know, I've been hurt before. I was hurt when I was covering the Israeli incursion into Ramallah last year, and I have no desire to be hurt again. I have a daughter and a wife at home in Washington, and you know, while I do think this story is worth some risks, you know, it's not worth losing your life over, and it's not worth putting yourself in danger that's kind of foolish or reckless.
You know, I was thinking about you because March 31st, Monday of this week, was the anniversary of the day that you were shot.
It's interesting, yeah. I was, someone had sent me an email asking what had happened, and they sent that email on March 31st, and it struck me, you know, it was 1 year since I had been.
Yeah, what happened when you were shot?
You know, it was so much of a different story than the story now, because we didn't, I mean, here we kind of knew what was going to unfold. We had, like I said earlier, we had a sense of what was next. When I was in Ramallah, I had no sense. I went there just because I expected the Israelis to retaliate for a suicide bombing in Netanya, and I wanted to be in, you know, in the right place at the right time. What followed was a full-scale invasion, and I mean, the Israelis retook the city, and I was caught there. I had no clothes. We had no food, and I basically just kind of hunkered down in my hotel, the first room. I didn't want to get outside and you know, to take too great of risks. By the fourth day, you had a sense that things had kind of loosened up. You felt a little bit more comfortable, and I was making my way around with a colleague, going to hospitals, talking to families, trying to, you know, always interested in the mood. I mean, I think sentiments are so important in how a story unfolds. And by the end of the day, I was headed back to my hotel, and one shot rang out, and it hit me in the back. It went into my left shoulder, and it hit the tip of my spine, but it didn't hit the spinal cord, and then went out my right shoulder. And I fell to the ground. You know, we were kind of stranded there. I mean, it turned out to be a long story. We were stranded there. We tried to call an ambulance. No ambulance could come. And my colleague helped me up, and we kind of walked for about, it seemed a mile. It was probably just 100 meters or so. And I got to a first aid Israeli unit ahead who gave me first aid. And then a Palestinian hospital took me in that night, and the bullet had left my back, so I just had to bandage it, basically. And then later on, I was transferred to Jerusalem, and then I had surgery at Johns Hopkins. You know, I was at the Boston Globe at the time, and we filed a complaint with the Israeli army because we believe the army shot me when I was in Ramallah. The circumstances are, you know, still remain unclear, and I do play it through my mind a lot about why I was shot, you know, then and there. And I think the last correspondence I had was that they couldn't determine who had shot me, so it's probably going to be, you know, one of those things that's always unresolved.
So you'll probably never know who shot you and how it happened.
Right, that's right. And It wasn't crossfire. I mean, it was one shot, and it hit my back high up. And, you know, who knows where they were aiming, but it was a very specific shot that actually passed under my flak jacket. And I was lucky that, you know, my wife's a doctor, and when she looks at the wound, she just, you know, shakes her head, because it passed within about a millimeter of my spinal cord. So I do feel really lucky.
We're recording this interview, and right now it's Thursday morning, 10:30 East Coast time. What time is it in Baghdad?
It's 6:30 in Baghdad right now. It's, you know, the sun's setting. It's kind of dusk outside, and you know, dusk always seems to come a little earlier the past couple of weeks because of the oil fires that are burning on these outskirts. It's kind of, you know, not only the sky has a dark tint to it, but even the buildings have started to have a film of black soot over them that adds to the kind of dreariness of the city.
Now, I know by the time our listeners hear this, the story in Baghdad might have changed and might have changed dramatically. But right now, it's 6:30 in the evening, your time. What are you going to do? What are you planning to do for the next few hours?
Well, what the routine has become over the past couple of weeks is you try to report as much as possible during the day, gather information, and then wait to see what happens in the evening, which is usually bombing. Bombing steps up quite a bit in the evening. Because it's become routine, it's become, you know, I almost hate to say it, but it's become less of a story in some respects. Just the act of it. Now, obviously, the repercussions of it, that is very much a story, but it's very difficult to see those repercussions at night. You kind of wait for that to begin, and then you begin writing around 9 or 10 at night, and we usually write till 2, 3. Some people are staying up until 6 in the morning to finish writing. And then you get up the next morning and do the same thing. There's very little downtime. You know, often when you're on assignment, there is a certain downtime. You have time for dinner, to take a couple hours off. That really isn't the case here. It's pretty much an around-the-clock story. And it's kind of wearing, I mean, in that sense. You find yourself trying to get up as early as possible because you don't want to miss anything, and then staying up as late as possible because you want to, you know, treat the story right.
A lot of the time when you're writing, there's bombing going on. Right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so how is the bombing affecting your writing? I mean, it's not not exactly a great atmosphere.
No, it's funny. The first night I've been, one of my closest friends is here in Baghdad as well, so we've been working out of the same room at night, and it was funny. The first night we were so, alarmed by the bombing, we put our flak jackets on and our helmets and actually slept in them. And it was kind of, you know, looking back on it, it was kind of comical. Now, you know, we don't even get out of the chairs when the bombing happens again. And I mean, I think it's sad in a way. I think that's, you know, it's always a danger as a reporter to get too used to things. You lose your eye a little bit. You don't pick up on things that you might have picked up on when it first started. But I guess the flip side of that is that you almost have to bring a certain normalcy to it. Otherwise, it would be unbearable. So we do write. We'll pause for a few minutes as the bombing goes on, trying to at least understand or at least see where it's happening. But then, you know, you're facing a deadline. You can kind of keep on going. And you do kind of put it to the back of your mind a little bit.
Well, given that you've already been injured while covering conflict, you must really believe in the importance of covering the war in Iraq. You must really believe it's worth putting yourself at risk to cover what's happening in Baghdad. Why is it so important to you?
You know, there are certain, and at some point the risks are too great to cover a story. But I think this story is such a moment for this country and a moment for the region that it is worth some risks. I do think, you know, this war, and like I've already emphasized, is, you know, what follows this war is going to define the region, define this country for a generation. And, you know, as a journalist, you can't help but feel strongly about covering that moment, understanding it, and seeing how it plays out.
And what about as a person? Do you feel personally that there's something very important to you to be there and bear witness to what's happening?
You know, I think professionally, you feel an obligation to understand the story, to bring a depth to the story that might not be there otherwise. You know, on a personal level, I think you feel the story, and I think if you quit feeling the story, then you probably shouldn't be writing it. you know, I recall once one of the first stories I did here was about a woman who had sent her son off to the front on the first night of the war. And it, you know, it was a story that probably wouldn't have been told otherwise. They said goodbye. She waited till the bus left. Tears were running down her face, and now she's back in her, you know, miserably poor apartment, waiting for news that she hopes will never arrive. She's constantly listening to BBC and radio Monte Carlo, and there's a certain dread that kind of defines her life right now that seems to order it in a lot of respects. I've always felt as a reporter that you give voice to people that don't have voices. And I think that's one of the great things that reporters can do, is that we go out there, we try to find stories, we try to see anecdotes and experiences and lives. I mean, to put it most broadly, and to bring life to, I mean, bring voice to them, to bring them alive for readers that wouldn't be able to come into contact with them otherwise.
Did you get the impression that this woman wanted her son to serve in the army, or that he was coerced into serving?
You know, it's a mixed bag, and I think there's no question that a lot of what motivates the defense of this government right now is motivated by fear and repression. It's a spectacular record of brutality over the past 30 years. But at the same time, I mean, she was convinced, and who knows, I mean, if she was speaking completely honest to me or not, but she was convinced that he did want to defend Iraq. It wasn't a defense of the government, and she never phrased it in those terms, but she did phrase it in defense of his country. And, it's hard to gauge those sentiments. It's incredibly hard, and I think it's going to be a sentiment that has a very decisive impact ahead, but it's still perhaps in the early stages. You got the sense from his sisters, you know, five of them that lived with her, they didn't want him to go. And I think, like a lot of people in Baghdad, there's a fear that this is a losing cause, at great cost to the people that are going to be fighting it.
You're of Lebanese descent. And you also, you speak Arabic, so you can speak directly to the Iraqis without a translator. Do you think that the Iraqi people who you're talking to might feel more comfortable with you because you speak their language, and might perhaps be willing to tell you things that they'd feel uncomfortable telling other American journalists?
At a certain level, I think that's the case. But you still are an outsider. I mean, there's no question that an unmediated conversation is going to be much more effective. And there is a certain trust that comes with that, a certain familiarity, a certain kind of shared experience. I think that's there's no question about that. But Iraq is a country that feels very strongly, has a very strong sense of itself, or at least Baghdad does. And you still are a foreigner, and you still are an outsider. And there is that, not suspicion. I don't want to overstate it, because I think Baghdad is remarkable for its hospitality and generosity, these traditions that Arab culture celebrates. But at the same time, you're a stranger, and there's only so far people will necessarily, might go with a stranger.
Well, I wish you safety, and be well. Thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with what's ahead. Thank you, Anthony.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is reporting from Baghdad for The Washington Post. Our interview was recorded this morning.